He knew the woman's voice immediately. Goodwin. Though Carrie was privy to only half of the conversation, she could tell it was a vendor calling about an intracranial pressure monitoring device. Goodwin sounded uninterested from the start. She ended the call with the terse parting words, "Let me get back to you when I have time." A number of unrelated conversations had been recorded over several days, and Carrie and David listened to each without learning anything especially interesting about Goodwin. She chatted with Evan pleasantly enough, always about the VA. It was utterly unrevealing. Goodwin gave a resident some thoughtful advice, which Carrie thought a bit out of character for the Ice Queen. Twice, Goodwin spoke by phone with her mother, and Carrie got the distinct impression a vendor call would have been more welcome. It was not until the third day of recordings that Carrie heard a new voice, an older voice she recognized, Cal Trent. It took Carrie just a few seconds to realize Goodwin had an edge to her voice. "Hello, Cal," Goodwin said. "Have a seat." According to the timestamp on the recording device, the conversation took place 2 days after Carrie's accident.
"Thanks, Sandra. How are you?"
"I'm fine. Need anything to drink?"
"No, I'm fine. What's up? Why the urgency?"
"I'm worried," Goodwin said. "I think we need to scale back, even go dark." Cal's laugh expressed his utter contempt for the idea.
"Good one," he said. "What's next on your agenda, Sandra?"
"Please, Cal."
"The pipeline is full. We're moving forward. That's the plan."
Carrie glanced at David's notepad where he jotted the word pipeline and put a question mark after it. "I don't think that's a good idea," Goodwin said on the recording.
"And how will the board take it when we pull funding for your movable prosthetics initiative?" Trent asked. "How many of the millions we've committed to the VA have already been spent? That's not something your bosses are going to give up on easily. A lot of questions will be raised. A lot of fingers will be pointed at you. And then I think you'll point them back at me. And we can't have that, can we? I'm not trying to be subtle or coy here, Sandy. I think you get my meaning. I've got a pipeline of patients to send your way, and we're going to send them. You get that DBS surgery done. That's your job. And you let me do the rest."
Silence.
"Are we all set here?" Trent asked.
"We're all set," Goodwin said, her voice going soft. Carrie and David heard background noise as Trent got up from his chair, opened the office door, and closed it. The recording picked up Goodwin's labored breathing and other sounds, a desk drawer opening up, a squeaking chair, and the click of Goodwin's keyboard as she furiously typed a message. David shut off the recorder and turned to face Carrie.
"What exactly is a movable prosthetic?"
He glanced at his notes.
"I'm assuming it's not what's commonly out there."
David's eyes had gone wild. Basra perked up her head, yawned, stretched, climbed down off the sofa, and padded away. Evidently, the energy in the room had become too much for her to handle. "I'm sure he's talking about reliable neural interface technology, RENET," Carrie said. "I've attended a few lectures about it at different neurosurgery conferences over the years. One lecture showed a video demonstration of a man using targeted muscle re-innervation to pick up a coffee cup."
"Re-innervation?" David repeated for confirmation. "Is that like the reanimation of nerves?"
"Very much so," Carrie said, nodding. "There are still nerves firing even after a limb is severed. It's just that the signal doesn't go anywhere. With computers, robotics, and a whole lot of sophistication, a prosthetic can learn to recognize these signals and contract the muscles like a working limb. TRM-controlled prosthetics is very cutting-edge stuff."
"And there's nothing like it at the VA currently?"
She shook her head. "Not that I know of, but I'm just a technician, remember?" Carrie said technician with exaggerated contempt.
"Is it possible that Trent is getting his DBS patients from outside the system?"
"That's what it sounded like to me," Carrie said. "Patients come to the VA through a very bureaucratic process. If someone is bypassing that system, there's got to be a good reason for it."
"Maybe Goodwin wanted to minimize your role at the VA to keep you from finding out what the circumvention was all about."
Carrie processed David's words. "Maybe the last DBS surgeon got too close to that answer," she said. Now it was David's turn to process.
"What have you gotten yourself into here, Carrie?" he asked.
"I don't know," Carrie said. "I really don't know."
They listened to hours of Sandra being Sandra and found nothing of further interest on those recordings. Nothing incriminating, nothing to explain what she and Cal were doing. David put his hands behind his head, stretched, and looked to the ceiling.
Annika is gonna be pretty ticked off at me, David said.
Yeah? Why's that? Carrie asked.
Because I got a feeling this story is gonna take a hell of a long time for me to write.
Chapter 46. Carrie returned to the VA the following morning, unsure what the next step should be. She had hoped David's plan would provide further clarity, but instead it created more seemingly unconnected threads. How did Abington's and Fasciani's disappearances relate to Goodwin's ambitions with regards to reliable neural interface technology? How did Abington come to join the DBS program? How many vets had been treated? Where were they all living? These were questions that extended far beyond her purview. She was at the VA to drill and to insert wires, and nothing more. Sandra Goodwin had erected a wall between her and the patient's postoperative care for a very specific reason, but what was it? And who exactly was Bob Richardson? Carrie felt confident he was more than a bit player in Cal Trent's world. In this way, Dr. Finley appeared marginalized as well. Trent's operation included a cast of unknowns, of people who played pivotal roles and were introduced only on a need-to-know basis. In the intervening hours from when she heard the recording to her return to the hospital, Carrie did some digging on Cal Trent and sent an email to David with a fairly exhaustive dossier. Admittedly, it gave them no real insights. Trent got his BS in mechanical engineering from the University of Miami and went on to receive an MBA from Northwestern. He was an associate with the consulting firm McKinsey & Company and worked for BEA Systems before he found employment with DARPA. Trent had been married for 18 years with two kids and a permanent residence in Bethesda. He seemed like a regular guy, though graft and corruption stained the noblest professions. Carrie and David agreed not to play the recording for anybody, not Dr. Finley, and certainly not the police. They had nothing criminal to investigate, just a lot of innuendo. As for Dr. Finley, if he knew Carrie had secretly recorded Sandra Goodwin, she'd be fired in a heartbeat, and any hope of closure would be lost. So long as Dr. Finley employed her, Carrie could investigate Goodwin and Trent from the shadows. Until Carrie was officially cleared to operate, all DBS procedures were on hold, and waiting patients would need to be rescheduled. During this downtime, Dr. Finley informed Carrie of his plans to conduct neurological exams on both DBS and regular VA patients and get caught up on some backlogged paperwork. Carrie could not stay at home and do nothing all day, so she came to the VA to get caught up on her journal reading, or so she said to Dr. Finley. In reality, Carrie was there to keep her eyes and ears open. When Dr. Finley invited Carrie to join him in examining another vet from the DBS program, Carrie jumped at the chance. It was Ramon Hernandez Redux. This vet's name was Terry Bushman, an uber-fit male in his early 30s with short-cropped blonde hair, his arms covered with tattoos and scars. Carrie asked the same questions of Bushman as she had of Hernandez. The answers were decidedly similar. No experience with voice illusion, no issues with his DBS, and while he expressed lingering PTSD symptoms, they were not nearly as debilitating as before. Same as Hernandez, there was some asymmetry of Bushman's neck where the stimulating wires had been tunneled from the scalp, and he had small scars on the chest where the generator was placed. Near the end of the exam, Carrie asked Bushman to tell her how he got involved in the program.
"I was living at a halfway house," Bushman said. He had a youthful voice, like a California surfer. "So these guys from DARPA show up, give me all sorts of psych testing. And next I know, I'm living at a different halfway house outside of Boston with wires in my head. Simple as that."
Carrie had wondered if Ramon had recruited Bushman, or if he had ever met Abington or Fasciani. The answers were no to all. Carrie got some background on Bushman, and it seemed he had a decent relationship with his family, nothing like Abington. Carrie was willing to accept a dead end when she hit one, but still, something did not make sense. Why would two vets seem perfectly fine, and two others exhibit strange neurological behaviors? Carrie joined Dr. Finley in the cafeteria for a post-exam coffee. It was approaching dinner time, and Bushman was Dr. Finley's last patient of the day. He was exuberant as ever.
"I think in another week, you should be recovered enough to get back to the OR," he said, When I first met Terry, he suffered from debilitating, uncomplicated PTSD with persistent re-experiencing of the traumatic event, had trouble with crowds because he associated the stimuli with the trauma, and there was a lot of self-medicating going on. Now look at him.
It is impressive, Carrie admitted.
We have 4 cases like Terry Bushman and Ramon Hernandez. 4. When we get to 10, I think we'll be able to trumpet success.
What about the others? Carrie asked.
Dr. Finley's glow dimmed. Not everyone gets better, Carrie. Not every drug, not every therapy works a miracle. But these 4 represent the possibilities. We need to stay positive.
Do you mind if I look over your patient records?
Dr. Finley's prominent eyebrows rose 1 inch or so. I guess, sure. Mind if I ask why?
Call it professional curiosity. I just really want to know these men.
Carrie got a quick nod of approval. Yes, of course, he said. I'll pull them together for you, and you can look at them in the morning.
Those files, Carrie believed, would show her whether other vets left the neuro recovery unit under special circumstances, like Abington and Fasciani.
Thanks, that would be great, she said. Dr. Finley stood. Time for me to go home. You should do the same. I'm worried you're going to push yourself too hard.
Carrie thanked him for his concern and returned to her office to gather her things. She was only there a few minutes before someone knocked on her door. Carrie's heart nearly stopped at the sight of Sandra Goodwin lurking in the open doorway, as if she'd been there watching for some time. Without an invitation, Goodwin entered Carrie's incommodious office, sporting a chilly smile. She wore her hair up in a tight bun, and the harsh glare of the fluorescence highlighted the severe angles of her face. Goodwin's sharp eyes bore down on Carrie in a way that turned her blood to ice.
Carrie, I'm glad I caught you, Goodwin said in a honey-dripped voice. Do you have a minute?
I was just heading out, Carrie said.
This won't take long, Goodwin said coolly.
Sure, Carrie said. What can I do for you?
I think you and I got off on the wrong foot, Goodwin said, and I'd like for us to be friends.
Because you know I'm on to you, Carrie thought.
Sandra, I really don't know what you're talking about. I've kept a clear line between my job and what Evan does ever since our little chat.
If you want to be professionally cordial, then perhaps you'll explain to me why you signed Abington and Fasciani out AMA.
Carrie almost let slip something about reliable neural interface technology, which could have been disastrous if Goodwin found out she'd been bugged. I told Dr. Finley I had little choice. They were both extremely insistent.
I saw Fasciani after surgery.
He was so doped up on Valium, I don't see how he could have done that. Something flashed in Goodwin's expression that gave Carrie shivers. You saw him? Goodwin asked. Could you explain yourself, please?
Carrie's chest tightened. Goodwin had her trapped, damn it.
Yes, I went up to see him after my surgery, Carrie admitted.
I honestly think this policy of yours is ludicrous.
Think what you will, Goodwin said in a sharp-edged voice. It's my law, and I'm surprised and more than a little disappointed you decided to ignore the directive.
Well, I apologize, Carrie said rather insincerely. But you need to see this from my point of view.
You aren't credentialed by us, Carrie, and for that reason alone you have no business interacting with the patients outside the OR. I thought this was clear.
Goodwin leaned against a wall and let her white lab coat fall open to show off the scrubs she wore underneath, as if Carrie needed the reminder they were both surgeons.
Eric could not have possibly given his consent, Carrie said. He was too drugged. But he did, Goodwin retorted. I was called to the floor and I signed the papers after he issued his demands. I spent time trying to talk him out of it. I'm sorry I don't have any of those conversations recorded so you could believe me.
She gave Carrie a foxy grin. Carrie held her breath, paralyzed, expecting any moment to be accused of spying.
What do you want me to say, Sandra? I'm not at all comfortable with how you've handled this. I did an invasive procedure on 2 men who checked out AMA and subsequently vanished. Something isn't right.
Goodwin took a step into Carrie's office and gave a look meant to incite fear.
I'll tell you what isn't right, Goodwin said. I have a presentation due in a couple days for an upcoming meeting with the top brass here. I have to go through every surgical procedure from the past year and catalog every complication. That's going to take me hours. If you so want to be a part of this team, I think you should do the work.
Me? Carrie could not contain her incredulousness.
It would be a shame to inform the VA of your unwillingness to follow my rules. I could get you suspended in about 5 minutes and fired in a day. You'll be out of here quicker than it takes me to fill out an AMA form.
Carrie eyed Goodwin with disgust.
That's blackmail, she said.
No, Carrie, darling. It's called being a team player. Stay right here. I'll come down with the files. You don't have access to the electronic system, so I'm afraid paper will have to do. And I'm afraid you can't remove anything from the premises, but that's okay. You're used to working late nights, aren't you?
The glimmer in Goodwin's eyes dimmed along with her phony smile. Chapter 47. Drained did not capture Carrie's whole body exhaustion. The stacks of medical records took up most of her desk space. The work was decidedly tedious and excruciatingly time-consuming. Many of the files Carrie reviewed were several inches thick and offered no means by which to conduct a keyword search for complications. Carrie had to painstakingly review each case down to the last period. She could have punted on the whole thing, done a half-baked job, but that was not in her nature. If she were going to do something, even scut work, she'd do it right. That was just her wiring. The complications Carrie recorded on her impressive spreadsheet were commonplace and did not denote a pattern of incompetence, or at least nothing Carrie could derive from the data. The VA might not have state-of-the-art equipment like White Memorial, but it appeared to be a first-class facility with top-notch surgeons. Even though Carrie thought Navarro was an ass and Goodwin a shrew, they each performed their respective roles admirably, and even at times in exemplary form. Carrie's grueling residency had trained her for endurance work, and she probably could have gone another hour before giving in to fatigue. Thankfully, that was unnecessary. Carrie closed the last manila folder and fired off a tersely worded email to Goodwin with her Excel spreadsheet attached. Her findings corresponded with well-established industry standards. Stereotactic radiosurgery, more commonly known as gamma knife surgery, had the lowest rate of complications. By contrast, transsphenoidal surgery, a relatively safe procedure, had a statistically significant number of issues. The other surgical complications Carrie came across ran the gamut and included hematomas, infection, and leakage of cerebrospinal fluid. There were a number of non-surgical complications, like deep venous thrombosis and a few cases of pulmonary emboli, cardiac arrhythmias, blood sugar, and electrolyte imbalances, but all in all, the VA seemed to be well within the norm of surgical maladies. Carrie massaged her eyes and took a long drink of the Diet Coke that had kept her alert these many hours. While Goodwin may have won the battle, the victor in the larger war had yet to be determined. Carrie was going to blow the lid off Goodwin's dealings with Trent. It was just a matter of time. Carrie shut down her computer, collected her purse, and turned out the lights. Her depleted resolve sparked back to life as she closed and locked her office door. But the feeling was fleeting. Her limbs were heavy with fatigue, and the idea of making the long drive home seemed intolerable, perhaps even dangerous. Studies proved drowsy driving was equivalent to drunk driving, and her eyes were already closing. The on-call room beckoned her, and Carrie gave in. 4 or 5 hours or so of sleep, and she could be back at her desk, looking through the files Dr. Finley had promised to provide by morning. Carrie headed to the on-call room through hospital halls that were deathly quiet. Eerily so. She reached the stairwell without encountering a single person, unusual for any time, day or night. The harsh glare of the white vinyl floor was like needles in her eyes. Carrie made an unusually quick ascent to the third floor. A creeping fear tickled at the back of her neck that hastened her strides. Maybe it was the jogger in the park or the car crash, but the quiet made her jittery. All three on-call rooms were vacant, and Carrie opted for the one at the far end of the hall. She locked the door behind her and glanced at the time on the analog clock mounted to the concrete wall. 3 o'clock in the morning. What a brutal day. Carrie plumped down on the thin, unforgiving mattress and heard every click in her stiff and achy joints. At least she had on scrubs, which were just as good as pajamas, if not better. For a moment, she felt incredibly alone and lonely and wished David was with her. But the feeling faded as Carrie closed her eyes. Even her resentment and anger toward Goodwin could not keep her from drifting off. Exhaustion took over,
and thoughts of David and Goodwin receded into the back of Carrie's consciousness. Her body melted into the bed, legs and arms became heavy as her breathing turned shallow. The minute hand on the clock ticked off seconds like a hypnotic metronome. Then the noise was gone. All noise was gone. Then, sleep. At last, sleep, finally, sleep. Until something woke her. Carrie's eyes fluttered open. She had no idea how long she'd been out, a few minutes, a few hours. The darkness was impenetrable, and she could not see the clock on the wall. Her body felt queasy, off kilter from having woken up so suddenly. Her eyes would adjust to the dark, but right now Carrie could not make out any shapes at all. She might as well have been blindfolded. But her ears worked just fine, and they picked up a faint noise, the slight sound of a metallic click. That noise must have awoken her. Carrie listened, but the only sound now was her heart slamming against her ribs. The noise came again, and this time it was distinct and distinguishable. It was the sound of a doorknob turning ever so slightly. The soft jiggle of the handle boomed in Carrie's ears, and the click of the cylinder as it turned thundered loud as a crashing wave. She was about to call out that the room was occupied when a terrifying thought came to her. She had locked the door. The knob should not be turning at all, and yet it was. David had shown her how easily he manipulated those antiquated lock tumblers with a pick and a tension wrench. This was not just a resident looking for a place to crash. Someone specifically wanted to get into her room. Carrie's heart lodged in her throat, beating like a hummingbird's wings. Terror turned her skin clammy. She heard the noise again, a steady creak like the winding of a spring. Her thoughts raced. This corridor was empty. She could call out for help, but whoever was beyond that door would be on her in a flash. If he had a knife, a gun, her time in this life would be over. The door opened a crack. Carrie held her breath and somehow managed to keep perfectly still. Her eyes remained open, but only as slits. She wanted to appear to be sleeping, the equivalent of playing dead. Light from the hallway illuminated the silhouette of an imposing figure entering her room. He was at least 6 feet tall and solidly built. Carrie's breathing turned ragged, and every effort she made to slow it faltered. The intruder had to think she was sound asleep, unaware. Her body heated as fear took hold. This can't be happening. This is a dream, a nightmare. Wake up, Carrie! Wake up! But she was awake, and it was a battle not to scream. The man closed the door behind him, but left it open so a bit of light seeped in. He needed to see to attack. It was enough light for Carrie to track his approach. Breathing through her nose, Carrie could not seem to take in enough air. If she hyperventilated, he would know she was awake. The man took another silent step toward her. Carrie dug her fingers into the bedsheets as if she were dangling from a cliff. She saw the pillow in his hands, presumably one taken from an adjacent on-call room. He had not come here to sleep. She was certain this man had entered her room with the intention of smothering her to death. As her mind clicked over, Carrie understood the plan's sickening simplicity. No blood, no screams, no loud noise of any sort. She could be disposed of in a relatively clean manner. Her body could be removed from the building in a laundry bin. The assassin remained absolutely calm. Carrie's panic induced feelings of paralysis she prayed to overcome. There would be a moment, a precise opportunity, when surprise would be her singular advantage. He reached the edge of her bed and looked down at her. He watched her sleep. She could hear his soft breathing and feel his smothering presence. She kept her body rigid and still as the dead. Through her peripheral vision, she watched the man lift up the pillow. Wait, Carrie. Wait. Not yet. The anticipation became agony. Carrie held her breath and tried to keep her face muscles from twitching. The man took his time. She was asleep, after all. He maneuvered the pillow over her face like a bombardier setting his sights on a building below. At the last possible second, Carrie lashed out with a punch that connected solidly with the man's unguarded testicles. She heard him make an agonized sound, one that gurgled up from his gut and came out as a hiss of air. The man dropped to his knees, disabled. Wasting no time, Carrie scrambled off the bed and darted for the door.
Chapter 48. From behind, Carrie heard the man call, "You bitch!" and felt his strong hand grab her ankle. With her free leg, Carrie kicked blindly backward and connected hard with something, his face, his chest, something. The blow was hard enough to knock him off balance. The man let out a yowl, more angry than hurt. His grip weakened and Carrie wiggled her ankle free from his grasp. Any hesitation could be fatal. Carrie bolted for the door, reaching it in one long stride. She spilled into the empty hallway at the same instant a scream like a low, moaning train whistle tumbled from her lips. "Help me," Carrie wailed, breaking into a frantic sprint. "Please, somebody." The VA was already like a crypt, and the on-call rooms were purposely out of the way to maximize quiet. A cardiac care unit was on the other side of the floor, Carrie remembered, but she would never outrun her attacker. The stairwell entrance was in front of her, about 30 feet away. On the wall adjacent to that door, a red fire alarm caught Carrie's eye. Surviving meant reaching one of the lower levels. She slowed to keep from ramming the door full speed. Her feet skidded on the vinyl floor as if it were made of ice. With her left hand, Carrie ripped the stairwell door open, and with her right hand she reached out and pulled the alarm. The strobe mounted above the stairwell started to flash, and a series of loud beeps sounded like a fleet of trucks backing up. Carrie took only 2 steps and jumped the remaining stairs. Her momentum carried her into the concrete wall of the landing below. She bounced off the wall, but managed to stay on her feet. The piercing alarm drowned out most of her screams. Above her, the man appeared in the doorway like some nightmare incarnate. He made the same leap Carrie did, just as she reached the bottom of the next set of stairs. Her pursuer ping-ponged off the concrete wall, but quickly regained his footing and was soon on the move again. Carrie knew police were nearby. The VA police were well-armed officials with full police powers to enforce all federal laws. At least one VA police officer would be stationed at the front entrance. With luck, more. Descending rapidly, Carrie heard her footfalls reverberate in the stairwell as she crossed the landing to the next flight of stairs. Behind her, the man's wretched, rage-filled grunts intensified and grew closer. His pace had quickened. Carrie stumbled down the next flight of stairs and used her wrists to absorb most of the shock as her body careened off an unforgiving cement wall. One more flight to go. She screamed as loud as her lungs permitted. "Help me!" Impossible to know if anyone heard her. The crack of a gunshot roared from somewhere above, followed by the sound of concrete splintering as a bullet struck the wall. Carrie made another long jumper's leap with a cat's grace. She reached the bottom landing just as another shot rang out and hit the wall near her head. The bullet sent shards of concrete in every direction. Carrie launched herself against the steel panic bar and used her body weight to throw the door open. She tumbled out into the first floor hallway. The fire alarm was loud and strobe lights blinked everywhere. She would have to make a long run down an empty corridor to get help and would be an easy target even for a poor shot. Her eyes went to the wheelchair pushed up against the wall. Wasting no time, Carrie gathered the folded wheelchair and took up position against the wall. A second later, the hulking monster burst through the door with his weapon drawn. With an explosive motion, Carrie shoved the wheelchair out in front of her, catching her attacker completely unaware. The strike connected at the lower part of the man's legs, and he went toppling forward over the wheelchair, arms outstretched to brace his fall. He landed hard, and the force of his fall dislodged the gun from his hand. The weapon skated down the hall, maybe 10 feet from Carrie. She was already headed in that direction, but so was her pursuer. His athleticism was nothing short of extraordinary, and he got back to his feet in a blink. Her focus was on the gun. It seemed counterintuitive, but going for the weapon would get her killed. He was fast as a puma, and would be on her the second she picked up the gun. But there was another solution, keep him from getting the gun. Without breaking stride, Carrie gave the pistol a solid kick with her right foot, and it slid like a shuffleboard piece a good distance. Carrie bellowed at the top of her lungs, "Somebody help me! Bitch!" The man's harsh voice felt like claws raking her back. Carrie gave the gun another solid kick. She made it halfway down the hall and prayed help was nearby. Up ahead, Carrie saw movement. Her focus sharpened on a police officer with his gun drawn. He came charging forward, and close on his heels were 2 sizable orderlies. Carrie kept up her sprint, but something told her the man behind her had slowed. She glanced over her shoulder and saw him turn to go the other direction. But from that end of the hall, another armed police officer appeared, accompanied by 2 additional security guards.
The VA might not have all the best equipment, but budget constraints did not extend to security. The hospital was a military target, and therefore heavily guarded.
"Freeze!" one of the policemen shouted. "Hands in the air!"
Carrie ran into the arms of an orderly. Soon she was barricaded behind a wall of people. The man who had chased her was trapped between two groups of security personnel, and they were closing in fast. Their sharp voices, audible over the piercing alarm, commanded him to get down on the ground. He wore hospital scrubs like an orderly and filled them out like a football player, but she had never seen him at the VA before. But she had seen him, hadn't she? The jawline, perhaps that was the most familiar. His face was handsome and covered with hard guy's stubble. His gray wolf-like eyes held a devilish glint as he slowly raised his hand. Carrie stayed locked on his every movement. He paused to bite his wrists as his hands came over his head. The curious smile on his face was directed right at Carrie. Police approached with caution and again ordered the man to get face down on the floor. He obliged. Carrie stood back and watched the surreal events unfold from a safe distance. A second wave of security moved in and quickly had the man's hands bound with steel handcuffs. He lifted his head slightly off the floor, still keeping his menacing gaze locked on Carrie. His hateful eyes held a secret. Carrie could feel it. The police swarmed the area, speaking to each other and to their captive. Just then, the man started to grunt, not once, but several times, as if he had something lodged in his throat. He began to writhe and froth at the mouth. His legs went completely spasmodic. He wiggled like a distressed worm. Carrie thought she knew what had happened. When he put his mouth to his wrist, he'd ingested something, sodium cyanide perhaps, the more lethal of the two cyanide salts. The police realized their captive was in distress and flipped him on his back.
"We need a doctor," one police officer shouted.
Carrie rushed to help. The instinct to triage trumped what this monster had done to her and what he almost did. She was a doctor, but this was a hopeless case. She knew the highly toxic chemical interferes with the body's ability to use oxygen, and the brain dies within minutes of ingestion. It took four men to lift the convulsing detainee off the ground and onto a stretcher. The man frothed at the mouth, gurgled, and choked until he went still and fell silent. Carrie knew he had expired, but they would try to revive him. Cyanokit and sodium thiosulfate were both cyanide antidotes administered intravenously. At that point, he was in full respiratory distress, and Carrie ran alongside his stretcher, administering chest compressions over the middle of the chest. It was at this moment Carrie noticed a mark on the man's neck. She looked closely. A tattoo of a shamrock. Chapter 49. Detective Kowalski from the Boston PD would be showing up soon. Carrie tried to calm her crackling nerves, but was gripped by an icy terror. 6 hours after the attack, she could feel the man's powerful hand wrapped around her ankle. The VA police arranged transport, since she was too rattled to drive, and they also set up the meeting with the Boston PD. David drove up to the Bryants' home in a Zipcar rental and followed Carrie to her bedroom for a private conversation. The police would want to know why somebody had tried to kill her, and she wanted David's help with her answer. For a while, neither could speak. Carrie's body shook as though suffering a chill. She was exhausted physically and mentally, and it was David's news that pulled her from the fog of fear.
"I know who Bob Richardson is," he announced. "Emma finally accessed the database the DMV shared with law enforcement and came up with a 100% facial match."
Bob Richardson, according to the bio David printed off the corporate website, was a senior vice president at CerebroMed, a Virginia-based biopharmaceutical company focused primarily on discovering drugs affecting cerebral function. "What the heck is Bob Richardson doing giving me a virtual reality demo?"
"Are there any drug trials involved in what you're doing?" David asked.
Carrie felt her senses sharpening. Having something to focus on helped her to settle. "No," Carrie said, "unless Goodwin and Trent are doing something Dr. Finley and I don't know about."
"Which we know she is."
"But what?" Carrie asked.
"What if Goodwin is letting Trent experiment on these patients with a drug of some sort, maybe related to PTSD, maybe not, and in exchange she receives money for her advanced neurological procedures?"
Carrie mulled this over. I thought the virtual reality was insufficient, she said. But a drug? Now that could explain the palynacusis, some sort of side effect.
Yeah, a side effect, David said. One that Goodwin hid by getting those patients off the floor.
Carrie nodded. She wanted them gone. They weren't exhibiting poor judgment after all. She made them sign out AMA.
Not every patient has the side effect, David said. That was always one of our working assumptions. You just happened to investigate two who did.
It would explain why Goodwin didn't want me to check in on any of my patients post-op. She didn't want me to discover the side effect and alert somebody. It would have thrown the program into disarray. The vets would be subjected to a battery of tests, and maybe the drug would be discovered, came over. David thought.
You've got some success stories, though, right?
So far, I've met Ramon Hernandez and Terry Bushman, but Dr. Finley mentioned two others.
Maybe the side effects are temporary in some cases, so they just need time to clear.
It's possible, Carrie said.
Can you get access to the patient records of the vets who have been treated with DBS?
I had asked Dr. Finley if I could see them before I was attacked, Carrie said.
Why? It would be interesting to see if any other vets left the neuro recovery unit, like Abington and Fasciani. And speaking of your boss, what about him?
Carrie looked incredulous. Who, Alistair? No, she said. Alistair was Carrie's confidant, her mentor, the man who had given her career new life. But she could discount his involvement for other reasons, too. He didn't even know Richardson, Carrie said, and he had plenty of opportunities to introduce him to me. I think I have a pretty good read on people, and Alistair's commitment is to the patients, to this program. He didn't care that I went looking for Abington and Fasciani. He encouraged it. The problem was Goodwin, who, by the way, signed those AMA forms. She's the last link in the chain. Alistair has had my back with Goodwin since day one. There's a reason Goodwin has had it out for me from the get-go. She didn't want me on staff and was very vocal about it. David looked intrigued.
Goodwin runs the surgical staff, right?
That's right, Carrie said.
So what about Rockwell?
Carrie said, I was a special hire by Dr. Finley, but Sam Rockwell was on Goodwin's staff from the start, and a fully accredited VA neurosurgeon.
So Goodwin didn't want you hired.
Another reason, I think, the buck stops with her.
She gave you that bogus assignment, knowing you would be at the hospital late, David said.
Carrie went pale. You think Goodwin set me up to be killed?
It's possible, David said. And perhaps she did the same to Rockwell.
What do you mean?
What if Dr. Finley didn't know what Goodwin was up to, but Rockwell did?
David said. Carrie considered this. Rockwell knew, she said in a soft voice. He had to. Maybe he wanted out or was going to blow the whistle or something. That's why they tried to kill him.
And he was as good as dead, too, David said. At least until he started to wake up.
A sour, acidic taste burned the back of Carrie's throat. Goodwin must have known I was on my way to see him, she said.
It's possible Rockwell's doc called Goodwin to report a change in his condition. He was her employee, after all, so they probably had some kind of relationship. The other doctor might have mentioned you were coming up to see him.
And Goodwin told Trent, Carrie said. So what do we tell the police? Carrie stopped pacing and sat on the edge of the bed beside David.
We don't have much evidence, David said. We have a recording that really doesn't validate anything we just discussed. Everything here is conjecture, not proof. We go to the police with what we have, and the whole operation could go dark. Evidence could be destroyed, or worse, those missing vets might be permanently silenced, like Rockwell.
Carrie sat back on the bed and leaned against the wall to keep from tipping over. Fatigue seeped into her bones, leaving her completely enervated. A feeling of dread had wormed into her gut, and Carrie clamped a hand over her mouth to stifle a sob. What have I gotten myself into? She muttered, just barely holding it together. David took hold of Carrie's hand. He held her gaze until the fear swirling inside calmed like a windless sea. In that moment, the only sound Carrie could hear was her own racing heart. She felt strangely hypnotized by the flecks of gold that ringed David's penetrating eyes. For the first time, Carrie noticed the scar across David's cheek and wondered if he got that in Syria or some other dangerous place he called the office. For a moment, his touch completely possessed her and blocked out all the other sensations.
"Whatever you decide," David said, still holding her hand. "I'll be with you every step of the way."
Carrie's mother called from downstairs.
"Sweetheart, Detective Kowalski is here."
Detective Kowalski sipped from the mug of tea Howard Bryant had replenished. After greetings and introductions, it was time to get down to business. Everyone gathered around the kitchen table, Carrie, Irene, Howard, Adam, and David. Adam hung back, leaning against a wall, and made no effort to shield his glowering expression. His anger appeared reserved for and directed solely at David, for reasons Carrie could not fathom. Everyone was dressed casually, but the proceedings carried an air of formality. To his credit, Detective Kowalski, a trim man in his 50s with a salt and pepper crew cut, a snub nose, and kind brown eyes, took his time getting started. His patience helped Carrie to relax, though her hand shook with a persistent tremor every time she sipped her tea. David's touch had quieted Carrie's nerves, but the horror of what she'd endured persisted. Irene stood behind her daughter, her hands perched protectively on Carrie's shoulders.
"So, you've seen this guy before? That's what I heard."
Kowalski spoke with a heavy South Boston accent. It was an effort to focus, but she looked at the color picture of the dead man Kowalski put in front of her. The photograph did not show where he had taped the cyanide capsule to the inside of his wrist.
"At the park," Carrie said. "I thought he was following me. I guess he was."
She glanced at Adam, who looked distraught.
"Any reason?" Kowalski asked.
"I mean, I can't say I've ever come across a stalker who carried cyanide capsules on him before." "Can you order those online?" Howard asked.
Kowalski pondered the question.
"Yeah, I think so," he said. "I remember some guy took a pill in court after he was convicted of arson. Couldn't do the time, I guess. Maybe our guy had a get-caught plan as well."
"Maybe," Irene said.
Carrie and David exchanged glances. This was the moment of truth. Should they share what limited information they had? She gazed down at the photograph of the man with the shamrock tattoo, taken post-life, and felt five sets of eyes boring down on her.
"We've got no ID," Kowalski said. "Serial numbers are wiped clean from the gun. DNA testing will take some time, same as a dental match. For now, he's a John Doe. I don't know why this guy was after you, where your paths might have crossed other than the park, but there's something here. Patient of yours? Somebody you saw at the VA? One of your other jobs during medical school? At a party? I don't know you. You tell me."
Detective Kowalski took a long, unhurried drink and eyed Carrie over the rim of his mug. Carrie shot David a sidelong glance and picked up the photograph. She studied it silently for half a minute, then set it back down on the table.
"I don't know why he attacked me," she finally said.
Chapter 50. Everyone crammed into the compact foyer of the Bryants' home to say goodbye to Detective Kowalski. At the door, Kowalski paused and focused on Carrie once more.
"You have my card," he said. "Anything changes, you let me know."
"I will," Carrie said. "And thank you, Detective, for everything you've done."
"Wish I could do more," Kowalski said. "I'm sorry this happened to you. I really am. Just know we're gonna do everything possible to figure out who this guy was and what he wanted."
Carrie felt a stab of guilt, knowing it would be wasted effort. If the police even sniffed around DARPA, she firmly believed the whole operation would be shuttered, evidence purged, and everything Carrie had endured would be for naught. She owed it to Steve Abington and Eric Fasciani to hand the federal district attorneys an airtight case against Goodwin, Richardson, and Trent. Perhaps they would find the missing vets, or maybe evidence that Goodwin and Trent had plotted her murder or that of Sam Rockwell. Carrie had already formulated next steps in her mind. What she needed now was time alone with David to finalize those plans. With Kowalski gone, Howard and Irene returned to the kitchen to clean up, and Carrie went outside for a breath of fresh air. David followed. Carrie ambled down the walkway, and David caught up with her just before she reached the driveway. He took her hand again and pulled her in close to him.
"You made the right call," David said.
Recall about what?
Carrie and David whirled at the sound of Adam's voice. He wore the same saturnine look Carrie had observed in the kitchen, something truly unsettled. Adam folded his arms across his chest in a hostile manner, but kept his distance.
Right about what? He repeated.
Nothing, Adam, Carrie said. Just something David and I were discussing. It's private. Adam closed the gap between them until only a few feet remained.
Here's what I think, Adam said, his voice directed solely at David.
A shadow crossed Adam's face, a darkness Carrie found deeply troublesome.
I think since you two have been hanging out, a lot of bad things have happened to my sister.
David took a single step toward Adam. He remained calm and composed, non-threatening, non-confrontational. Of course, Adam did not see it that way. His eyes dared David to throw the first punch.
Adam, no, David said. This has nothing to do with me.
Yeah? Well, I don't see it that way, Adam said.
Carrie's been followed. Somebody broke into her bedroom. Somebody ran her off the road, and now someone tried to kill her. All that happened when? When, David?
Carrie came forward. She knew how close Adam was to exploding.
Adam, this isn't David's doing, Carrie said.
Adam maneuvered so close to David the two could almost touch noses. To his credit, David did not back away. But to Carrie's eyes, David was nervous, and rightly so.
Let's be level-headed about this, Adam, David said.
Yeah, let's, Adam said in David's face. This is my sister, and I love her, and I'd do anything to protect her. Anything. So I think the level-headed thing to do is to stay away from her. Whatever you're doing is dangerous, and if something happens to my sister, something happens to you. How's that sound?
Adam did not give an inch. His stare made Carrie hold her breath.
Are you going to hit me again?
David asked in a calm voice. By this point, Howard and Irene had noticed something going on, and they came outside to investigate. Irene rushed down the walkway.
What's happening? She called.
The spell seemed to break. Not a second too soon, Carrie thought. Adam turned around.
Nothing, Mom, he said.
He locked eyes with David once more.
David was just leaving, and I came out to say goodbye.
Braxton Price stood on the bank of the Charles River and watched the sailboats carve graceful lines across the rippling water. Any minute now, the call would come with his directive. 50-50, he thought. He knew which direction he wanted it to go. Gantry was a brother and a friend, and Carrie Bryant needed to die. How a brain surgeon had taken down Gantry, a well-trained, hardcore soldier, was difficult for Price to fathom. But his friend was dead, and that was that. The plan all along had been to take Carrie out in the parking lot early that morning, silent-like. Certainly not in the hospital, which had a larger police presence. Gantry had evidently improvised, and somehow she got the better of him.
Pity.
Something like this was bound to happen, and Price had warned his employers on several occasions about the risk of continuing after Rockwell's decommissioning. But once a grunt, always a grunt. And Price knew the suits were not about to take that kind of strategic direction from a low-level operator.
Whatever.
At least the group within DARPA who got this program off the ground had listened to him when it mattered most. Nothing about Price's motivations was especially patriotic. It was all about the money. And he'd balked at the notion of getting his muscle from a ragtag group of mercenaries whose loyalties could easily be compromised. Employing members from Price's former squad, like Gantry, assured him that even under extreme duress, his team would not falter. As individuals, each one of them had been tested, and while bones and bodies broke over in Afghanistan, allegiances never did. Price did not fight for his country. He fought solely for his brothers. When Gantry took that pill, he'd metaphorically leapt on a grenade to save his comrades. So Price would avenge him. It was not a matter of if, but when. The air was still and warm, not unusual for this time of year. Price wanted to remove his jacket, but it hid the wires that would scramble the expected call. It also concealed his favorite pistol, a Beretta 92FS with a 15-round magazine and impeccable long-range accuracy. At 4:30, the call came in. Price wore an earpiece, but that was commonplace these days, so nobody took notice of him talking to himself on the bank of the Charles River. Price reached into his jacket pocket and pushed the talk button without needing to check the phone's display.
Speak, Price said.
It's a no-go, a man's voice said in his ear.
Fine. Too much scrutiny right now. There's another way to get her removed.
Are we going dark?
No. Bad idea. We should go dark.
Not my call, the man said. Price could not help but smile.
Yeah, he said with a chuckle.
We're all just players here.
Chapter 51. Carrie woke to the sound of persistent knocking on her bedroom door. She panicked, thinking she was back in the on-call room and whoever was knocking had come to do her harm.
Carrie, are you awake? Adam asked. Can we talk?
She shook her head to clear the cobwebs from her mind.
Yeah, come in,
she said, her voice raspy with sleep. Adam entered, looking distraught. Dressed in the same clothes she had worn to her interview with Detective Kowalski, Carrie sat up in bed and spun around to put her feet on the floor. She eyed her brother with concern.
What's wrong?
She asked. She knew what was wrong, of course. Adam was coming unhinged. It was obvious in the way he had threatened David. The encounter had left Carrie rattled and unnerved. David, to his credit, took it all in stride, but Carrie wished Adam had apologized to him in some way. Perhaps Adam had experienced a change of heart. Adam eyed Limbic before plopping down in Carrie's desk chair. He slouched forward, and Carrie waited for him to speak.
What's going on, Adam? She asked at last.
David, Adam said in a hushed voice.
I have his number. I'm sure he'd love to hear your apology.
That's not why I came to talk to you.
Adam's expression was grave, his haunted eyes encircled by dark rings. Carrie felt the weight of his gaze.
What, then? She asked.
Outside, when I was toe-to-toe with him. I had thoughts that scared me.
Thoughts?
Adam bounced his legs up and down. Evidently, it was not enough to settle him, because he took a ballpoint pen from Carrie's desk and twirled it about his fingers like a miniature baton. He had learned the trick in high school and tried to teach Carrie the method, but she never quite caught on.
I wanted to kill him, Adam said.
Carrie gasped. Adam, what are you saying? The pen tumbled from Adam's hand and dropped to the floor. His gaze never left Carrie, and his cold stare sent a chill down her spine. Adam's eyes turned red, and he looked on the verge of tears.
I'm saying, I didn't just want to hurt him. I wanted to kill him.
His hushed voice was almost hypnotic.
It took everything in me not to grab his head and break his neck. I could have done it, too. I don't know how I held back. If you hadn't been there, I don't think I would have.
Carrie was stunned. A hollow pit in her gut allowed all sorts of feelings to roll in. Fear, disgust, sadness, hopelessness. It was a cocktail of emotions she could not process.
Why are you telling me this? She asked.
I'm telling you because I need your help, Adam said.
Carrie's guard fell immediately. She could look past Adam's confession to focus instead on the guilt and fear that seemed to consume him. She reached for Adam's hand, but he jerked away from her touch and rose to his feet.
What can I do to help? Carrie asked, rising as well. We'll talk to Mom and Dad, maybe find you a new therapist.
I don't need a therapist, Adam said through clenched teeth. I need the wires.
Carrie blanched.
What did you say?
You heard me, Adam said. I want those wires in my brain. Scramble this shit up so I stop thinking the way I do.
Carrie sank down onto her bed.
I can't do that, she said.
What do you mean you can't? You're in charge of the thing.
No, I'm just a surgeon.
This was an odd bit of irony, to embrace the role Goodwin had tried to thrust upon her, but she did not know what else to say.
You still have pull, don't you? You're the brain surgeon. You can get me in and get me cured.
It's not that simple, Carrie said.
Why?
Because it might not work.
Carrie cringed inwardly, knowing her argument had holes.
I was at dinner when you told Mom and Dad all about that Ramon guy. And who was the other one, a Bushman or something? It worked for them. You said it worked for two others, too.
But they're the exception, not the rule.
So? What's the worst thing that can happen to me?
Adam asked.
I get some surgery that doesn't do anything, then I go back to being a walking time bomb, but this time with actual wires in my body.
Carrie imagined Adam lying in a hospital bed, his head bandaged, muttering, "Follow my light, follow my light, follow my light," the way Steve Abington had. No, it's not that simple, said Carrie. I'm not entirely sure it's safe. Adam looked flustered.
Have you done the surgery before?
Yes.
And?
And two of my patients are missing.
Because of the surgery?
No, Carrie said, but corrected herself. I just don't know. I'm still trying to figure it all out. Carrie did not know how much to say. Yes, the DBS procedure could produce a specific side effect, but that was almost secondary to what Sandra Goodwin and Cal Trent were cooking up. And she still did not know how Bob Richardson from CerebroMed fit in this equation. Until she had some answers, she would never put Adam forward as a candidate for the surgery. Never. There's a reason I've been followed and twice nearly killed, Carrie said. Adam glowered.
Yeah, and I think that reason is David. Who knows who he's pissed off? Believe me, I've seen those embedded reporters in action. They can be like jackals. Maybe he dug up the wrong details on the wrong people, and now that he's hanging out with you, you're a target too.
I don't think so, Carrie said. Adam fell to his knees and clutched Carrie's hands with force.
Please, he said. I need to feel better.
He panted to catch his breath. His emotions choked back his voice, and his eyes brimmed with desperation. Until I know it's completely safe, I just can't do it. I'm sorry.
I don't care about any damn side effects, Adam shouted.
His ferocity took Carrie by surprise and frightened her.
I'll take any side effect right now.
Adam sprang to his feet and began to pace.
What I'm afraid of is that next time I feel like I did with David, I won't be able to hold back.
I'm sorry, Adam, Carrie said, but I just can't. And I don't want you to get your hopes up for this treatment either. We need to focus on therapy. You need therapy. Adam nodded glumly several times in quick succession. Without another word, he marched out of Carrie's bedroom but left the door open. She had expected him to slam it shut. Carrie exhaled loudly and took a moment to collect her thoughts. Part of her believed Adam would be fine if he did get the operation, that he'd be like Ramon or Terry Bushman, one of the Fab Four for whom DBS had been a life-saving procedure. Another part of her worried he'd vanish without a trace, like Abington and Fasciani. Until she had answers, there could be no wires. A few minutes later, Carrie heard a loud crash, followed by the shattering of glass. She raced downstairs, arriving in the foyer at the same instant as her worried parents. Without words, Carrie followed her parents into the living room, where Adam perched upon the couch so he could reach the photographs on the wall. His face had a wicked look, a darkness she had never seen. In his hand, Adam wielded a massive hammer that Carrie recognized from his toolbox. He had already shattered one photo, and now Adam swung the hammer at a second. This one, a picture of the siblings dressed in ski gear, taken at Sunday River in Maine. The hammer struck dead center, and the glass shattered into thousands of jagged pieces. Adam was not selecting photos at random. Each picture was of him and Carrie. He swung again, and this time shattered the glass on a picture of brother and sister taken in front of Big Ben when they were in their teens. The face of the hammer put a large hole where Carrie's head had been.
Adam, Irene screamed. What are you doing?
She sank to the floor, her hands covering her mouth, but not silencing her sobs. Howard Bryant held Carrie back. Adam was in a blind rage. Who knew what he would do if she approached? Adam cocked his arm back once more and aimed the hammer at another photograph, but paused to shoot his mother an annoyed look.
I'm just showing my sister the same kind of love she showed me, Adam said.
He brought the hammer forward again, and the sound of breaking glass filled the room once more. Chapter 52. The next morning, Carrie was back in her mom's Volvo, making what had become a routine drive from Hopkinton to the VA. Adam had stormed out after his terrifying tirade and never returned. Where he'd gone,